Hi, Watcha Hot.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner, and this is The Posner Show, and my guest today is Watcha Hot Ali. He is a writer and an attorney, and he was the lead author of the investigative report that was published by the Center for American Progress on Islamophobia in the United States called Fear, Inc. And we are going to talk today about Islamophobia in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombings. And you have a piece in Salon that was published this week on this topic, and it was called I Am Not the Tsarnaevs. You know, basically arguing that, you know, all Muslims do not have to explain or apologize for the acts of these individuals involved in the bombing. So I wanted to start off, you know, obviously, like, almost every hour there's some new piece of information that gets leaked out about the investigation. So probably as we record this and before it gets posted, there's going to be new pieces of information. But as of today, you know, I guess the younger surviving brother, Jokar, is being interrogated in his hospital room. And bits of information that have leaked out about this line of questioning is that he has said that their goal, his and his brother's goal in these bombings, was to defend Islam. And then just shortly before we started recording, there was a report in the Washington Post that said that he indicated to investigators that it was in response to the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, I just read that.
So it's interesting because it seems like that sort of those sorts of bits of information could be used to fuel the Islamophobia that we've seen evidenced in some people's reactions to discovering that the Boston bombers were Muslims. The most recent one that I saw this morning was Phyllis Schlafly calling for a revival of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Oh, that's nice.
So
wonderful. Yeah, I didn't read that one.
Yeah. So what do you, how do you, obviously, you know, that the notion that these bombings would in any way be a defense of Islam is just kind of a weird answer. And it's almost like the weird answer that someone who's looking to make an argument, like an Islamophobic argument, would seize on. You know, because it's just sort of like, what, how does that defend Islam?
No, and they've actually made this argument for the last, you know, 12, 13 years, in the sense that, you know, that Islam, whatever Islam is the primary inherent engine that drives people towards extremism. So the problem is not, you know, radicalized individuals, deranged individuals, unhinged individuals. It's their contact with Islam that makes them do it. And, you know, we can look at facts and evidence in the sense that we've seen that, you know, the path towards radicalization, well, there's first and foremost no profile, right, for individuals. There's no specific profile of the radical, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen in the MI5 report that came out in 2008, and like specifically every counterterrorism expert who has done, like, you know, significant analysis of the profiles of individuals like these brothers and others like Abdul Hassan Malik and people in Europe and so forth, say that usually Islam, or religiosity rather, is, you know, does not play a factor in the radicalization process. In fact, most of these individuals are quote-unquote religious novices, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, but that is like a sophisticated argument that, you know, doesn't play well on mainstream media. I mean, you know, Pam Geller and Robert Spencer are much more adept at using, like, you know, Islam is the problem. And I think, you know, the key thing we have to realize is, you know, these certain events that take place both domestically and even these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, they fulfill these narratives. So the number one narrative of actual extremists abroad, our enemies abroad, if you will, is that the West is at war with Islam. That is number one propaganda tool, and that is number one recruitment. And the two things that they usually use is the foreign policy of the United States. Look at, you know, they hate Islam. Islam, you know, is under attack vis-a-vis the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And also what they do is they feed on the extremism of Islamophobes here, who say, listen, every time something bad happens, these Islamophobes blame Islam.
Mm-hmm.
For example, that, you know, they say the 2010 Ground Zero mosque controversy that both of us covered, which was neither at Ground Zero nor at, you know, which is neither a mosque nor a Ground Zero, it's a Park 51 Community Center, inspired an extremist Pastor Jones, you know, the guy who looks like the Yosemite Sam with the handlebar mustache,
right.
To burn up, I mean, a total fringe loon character,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, was given an international stage, said, if you don't move the mosque, I'll burn the Quran. So he burns the Quran, and if you remember, in 2011, 2 weeks afterwards, the Afghan Taliban attack a UN compound.
Right, right.
And use, yeah, and so the point I'm trying to say is that this basically is not that unique in the sense that these, you know, foreign events and domestic events are used as part of the narrative propaganda of extremists abroad, both here and in, if you will, like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, to play out what I think is this global narrative post 9/11,
mm-hmm.
which casts the enemy, and this is a key thing, to cast the enemy as either quote unquote Islam and the West. And like I'm arguing in the article is, I've never met Islam.
Right.
And I don't think I've even ever met the West. Like, who is Islam and who is quote unquote the West?
Right.
And so the thing is, what's really interesting though is, we're still looking for motivations. There's still an ongoing investigation. We still don't know exactly the internal machinations and ideologies of these brothers. But that doesn't stop a segment from casting Islam and all those who are deemed quote-unquote Muslimi as these perpetual antagonists. And it's very convenient for them to say that, oh, Islam is the enemy. But then in the light of history and in light of facts, what do you say to those who have used Islam to do exactly the opposite? To both help law enforcement, to renounce extremism,
right.
To offer prayers of peace. So I think, it makes for a very tasty, easy mainstream soundbite that the Islamophobes latch onto. But it's our job to unpack it and see what's really behind these narratives and these casting of the characters.
Well,
I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, what's interesting to me, I mean, even casting a wider net than just kind of the usual suspects in the Islamophobia cottage industry, and just looking at the way the mainstream media started to cover the religion aspect of this story. So once it became known that the perpetrators of the bombing were Muslim, then people started to look at, well, how were they Muslim? Were they just culturally Muslim, or were they very religious? And then there started to be a discussion of how devout or religious they were, and that was both measured in terms of, oh, well, did they start praying five times a day, and did they start studying the Quran, and did they do these markers that indicate devoutness, or may indicate devoutness, not necessarily indicate devoutness, right? And then kind of equated that to, oh, well, they became more devout, and that word to me is in question, the meaning of that word is in question, and therefore that is what fed their radicalism. And that seems to me to be a misreading of what devout is and what it was that fed the radicalism, right? Because if they were devout, you could argue that would have caused them to bomb the Boston Marathon, right?
Yeah, you're delving into some tasty stuff there, sir. Like, we can unpack all this stuff for a while. It's true. I mean, if you look at the studies, right, the studies of actual counterterrorism and counterextremism experts who've been following this for the past 15 years, it seems that, actual quote-unquote devoutness, people actually understand the religion and people are religiously observant, it seems that overwhelmingly that seems to be a deterrent to this type of radicalized behavior. Now, of course, that doesn't, conform to the mainstream narrative that you just mentioned, but that's the reality. We've also seen in America, according to these MAPO studies, that, those Muslims who are quote-unquote devout and who actually attend the mosques happen to be more civically engaged and more politically and culturally engaged with America than those who aren't. Now, again, the reality runs completely contrary to the perception. And I think this is an interesting point to mention, that the reality of American Muslims is actually, if you look at all the studies that have been done, it's something that we should give us a sense of exhale and relief. They are, for lack of a better word, where that means mainstream, they're moderate, they renounce extremism, they renounce the ideology of Al-Qaeda. I think there's a diversity of they're the most diverse religious community in America. They're people who are religiously observant. They help law enforcement and so forth. But if you see the perception, like you just mentioned, the perception right now has Islam having the lowest favorability rating in its history ever. Like, even more so than October 2001, a month after 9/11, right? We see the rise of, mainstream politicians asking for loyalty oaths and, nationwide protests against mosques and, the anti-Sharia bills. And what they said is that the two key factors that explains the difference between what you said is the reality versus the perception of Islam and Muslims or the devout Muslim is, number one, ignorance. 60% of Americans say they don't know a Muslim. And number two is, this sounds like a cliched answer, but this is what the study shows, media misperceptions, where, anytime we talk about Islam or Muslims, it's a sensationalistic story. And as you and I know, just a couple of months ago, the American Sociological Review just came out with a study that said that, the covering of Islam, quote-unquote Islam, in the mainstream media has essentially been driven by the Islamophobes. So the Islamophobes in America have done a really good job in actually presenting and mainstreaming their fringe rhetoric and memes about Islam, to the mainstream media. And I think as such, what happens is there's a good Muslim and there's a bad Muslim. And I just want to make a point that after 9/11, it seems that the narrative of Muslims, right, in America is forever anchored in, like, what I call the stasis of national security. So the good Muslim is, there's twofold things here, real quick. The good Muslim is he or she who helps law enforcement, and, the bad Muslim is, by default, I guess the scary, either A, the person who commits criminal acts, or, this is what's interesting, what I've seen in my personal life, in certain circles, you're the good Muslim if you don't drink champagne, don't pray, and are culturally Muslim, but you are potentially a bad Muslim, or you're a suspect of being a quote-unquote bad Muslim, aka fundamentalist, aka extremist, aka not really quote-unquote American, aka misogyny, aka, brown and hairy and bearded. I mean, let's just throw it all out there, right? If you, engage, if you do those weird things, those fundamentalist-y things like, fast during Ramadan, or not eat pork, or a pray. And, I've had conversations like this in otherwise sophisticated intellectual circles, where people go, oh, you're one of those types of Muslims, once they find out that I don't drink. And you ask a big question, I just want to touch upon it, what I think are some of the roots of it, and what we're dealing with. And I think it plays out what we're seeing right now with these brothers, right? They don't look like the quote-unquote typical Muslim that we associate with these types of acts. You know, they don't look like the quote-unquote typical profile and the typical antagonist that we associate with these acts. And as we've seen and as we've already discussed, there is no model profile of, you know, radicalized individuals. They're very diverse.
I wanted to make a couple points in response to that. One was that there was an anecdote that emerged from all of the reporting about the brothers, about how Tamerlan, the older one who's now dead, was kicked out of a mosque in Boston for basically, you know, saying crazy stuff, right? I mean, it's like the opposite. So when Congressman Peter King had those hearings a few years ago where about the radicalization of Islam within the United States, trying to make this argument that Muslims, including American citizens, are being radicalized in the United States. And remember, he put out there that completely unsupported statistic that 80% of the mosques in the United States are radical or fomenting radicalism. I can't remember the precise description.
80-85%, right.
But he did use that completely unsupported 80% figure. Well, it would seem that from that anecdote about Tamerlan Tsarnaev getting kicked out of a mosque in Boston for standing up during the sermon and contesting various things that were being said, like a comparison of Martin Luther King Jr. to the Prophet Muhammad. Now I don't remember what the other one was, but there were a couple of things that he contested. And basically the people in the mosque said, I'm sorry, you're not welcome here if you're going to just, you know, get up in the middle of the sermon and start yelling at people and doing that sort of thing, which is the complete opposite of the stereotype that King was trying to put out there by saying, oh, well, you know, these mosques are just hotbeds of radicalism, and that's where these potential terrorists are learning what to do is actually in the mosques.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to, I think the root of it is, again, this wide, vast gulf between the reality of American Muslims and how they interpret and practice Islam versus the perception. Mm-hmm. And I think to really go back again to what we, you know, if we go to that permanent fork road in the global timeline, you know, 9/11, we unfortunately have to keep going back to it. You know, it's left that permanent wound, and there seems to be like this pre-9/11 narrative and post-9/11 narrative. And I always, you know, mention that, you know, the pre-9/11, the villains, right, the global villains were anyone who I think were deemed like Middle Eastern and brown, right? Mm-hmm. It was like the Iron Sheikh, you know, Iranians, it was the Lebanese, it was the Palestinians. It was like a motley group of exotic Middle Eastern brownness. But again, going back to what we've been talking about, you know, post-9/11, the enemy became quote-unquote Islam, whatever Islam is. And it became kind of the civilization global warfare between Islam and the West. And Islam encapsulates anyone who looks Muslimy or anyone, like you've already mentioned, is devout. And you made a really good point right now with that mosque story. I'll give another story where, you know, the elder brother stood up and started railing against the imam during Friday prayer. And as you know, during Friday prayer, there's a sermon.
Right.
And basically, the reason why he did it was because the imam was saying that Martin Luther King is worthy of emulation for his character traits, and Muslims can learn from Martin Luther King. So apparently the elder brother said, how dare you tell us to act like a quote-unquote non-Muslim? And exactly as you mentioned, the congregation said we kicked him out because quote-unquote he was acting crazy. You know, another mosque, and this goes to show you how labeling and language and perception and images are really important because they affect government prosecutions and interaction with law enforcement. Something that, you know, Muslim, those who are deemed Muslim don't have the privilege, like I've argued, than compared to those who are, say, white. You know, that the net is cast wide. And I'll give you one more example, is that there was a mosque, as you know, about 2 years ago in Orange County, California, who had a restraining order against one of these people who used to go to the mosque saying, hey, this guy's saying crazy stuff, you know, he's talking about jihad and this and that. And what we found out was that the gentleman who they received a restraining order against was actually a mosque crawler, a gentleman by the name of Craig Montel, who was paid by the FBI to infiltrate mosques and essentially say crazy things. So this is actually good news that the mosque that he was paid to infiltrate actually realized and recognized this, you know, actor was crazy and got a restraining order against him and kicked him out. And of course, this also shows us, you know, what happened with that mosque in particular was just a month before that was discovered, mosque leaders got an assurance from local, you know, law enforcement and the FBI that they weren't under surveillance. So, I mean, I kind of, you know, it does show you that, you know, actual American Muslims and American Muslim communities, those who are quote-unquote devout, overwhelmingly seem to be just as terrified and disturbed by the quote-unquote radical and obnoxious behavior of these individuals, just like any other quote-unquote American. And I said quote-unquote American, we could talk about that later as well.
Right. Well, I think also, you know, there's a couple of things packed into what you just said, and that is that there's another reason why the two brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers, did not fit a kind of stereotypical profile of the Muslim radical terrorist type is because they weren't Middle Eastern. And I think that it, for a lot of people, it was just sort of like, what? I mean, of course, there was the whole thing about people didn't even know where Chechnya was, and they confused it with the Czech Republic. So, you know, the Czech embassy had to put out a press release saying, no, we're a different country. We're different. This is a different, we're not Chechnya. It's the Czech Republic. So the ignorance level is fairly high. But a lot of people are trying to unpack their ideology in the context of Chechen history, and I guess it's turned out that their mother is not of Chechenian origin, but their father is. But just of that region and their conflict with, you know, the ongoing conflict that they've had with the Russian government, and before that, you know, in the Stalin era, that how they were basically expelled from Chechnya. And it's a very complicated history. And, you know, it's not that clear that that complicated history explains what they did either, because, you know, there seem to be a lot of factors playing into their behavior, some of which seem to include, you know, family issues and, you know, there's a lot of evidence that from social networking sites that they had that at least the younger brother was an enthusiastic pot smoker. And, you know, so, and I'm not saying that that pot smoking leads to any particular behavior either, but what I'm saying is it's a much more complicated, people are more complicated than a profile of what you would think a terrorist looks like or what you think a criminal looks like. And so, but I wanted to point out another thing in the coverage of trying to unpack their family's history in this region of the world. I was reading, I think it was on Yahoo News, a piece that was talking about how Islam, as practiced in that region of the world, has become, and I can't remember if they used the word devout, but they did talk about, the article did talk about, you see more women wearing hijab, and so it just seems like, oh, well, you know, it's becoming much more intense. Therefore, of course, you know, that must right? But the beef that Islamic insurgents have there, which has been made clear by a group there, which disavowed and distanced itself from the Boston bombings, is with the Russian government, not with the United States. And so there are these regional conflicts that play into it. But so while you have this article talking about how people are becoming more quote unquote devout in that region of the world, there was a Pew study that was put out this morning, and it said that Muslims in Chechnya in particular are the most likely of all the Muslims in that region to say that violence is unacceptable in Islam. It may be that these brothers were misled or delusional or something to think that somehow placing bombs at the finish line at the Boston Marathon was a defense of Islam, or think that it was somehow an appropriate reaction to the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, that may be what the younger brother is saying from his hospital bed, and I think that we won't know the full scope of that for a while. But, you know, it doesn't mean... They could be people harboring some serious delusions about, in particular, their own ability to have an influence on anything. I mean, obviously, like they had a horrific influence in that they killed and injured a great number of people. But in terms of an ideological influence, you know, it seems like they were harboring delusions about that.
If you look at Anders Breivik of Norway, you know, he ends up killing 77 people, leaves behind a 1,500-page manifesto detailing exactly why he did what he did.
Right.
And for him, the murders were necessary to, number one, both punish Europe for being multicultural, liberal, and allowing themselves to be Islamicized and transform themselves into Eurabia. And it was also a defense to keep Europe pure. So, of course, the question would be, you know, dear unhinged mass murderer, how do you think, you know, killing innocent people, especially youth, will allow you to defend Europe? And similarly with these two brothers who, I mean, I think you've read those articles that have shown that these were not the most intelligent and sophisticated of people, you know, who stayed behind 3 days after the bombing, who, you know, I think the younger brother went and even worked out. They didn't plan properly. They didn't have money. They, you know, they stopped by at a 7-Eleven. I mean, these are not, you know, brilliant masterminds. They do really look like confused, misled, you know, angry, radicalized youth.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it goes back to, you know, this key thing is, you know, people, like you mentioned, people are very comfortable casting certain characters into certain existing reductive narratives that have existed post 9/11, you know, which again, Islam is represented by the most violent and devout and Muslim-y looking person ever, those who, you know, are bearded or brown or angry or devout. And it just goes to show you this lack of sophisticated understanding. We saw commentators saying, oh, but how could he be a practicing Muslim? He smoked pot and had a girlfriend and, you know, listens to rap music. And that in itself can be unpacked. And to show you that, you know, this what you were discussing, that, like, apparently devout Muslims cannot be normal. Like, we can't watch Game of Thrones or listen to Eminem or even, like, you know, or you know, like, the sense that if you are a devout Muslim, you are culturally, ideologically, the utter antithesis of quote-unquote Western culture, whatever that means. And I think we're really seeing this play out. And even this hesitation to label the brothers white, I mean, they are from the Caucasus region. They're literally Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we've also seen, you know, what we saw in light of once they were identified is, you know, Fox News were like, well, you know, they're not really white. You know, it's Caucasians. They're, you know, they're ethnic. And this desire to make them, you know, this desire to, if you will, make them as foreign as possible, because that makes it much more convenient for us to project these type of reductive stereotypes and narratives. That okay, well, we can't really engage in what is necessary, you know, this self-critical, sophisticated understanding, unpacking of culture and identity and politics of history. It's much more easy to play out this reliable narrative that, you know, it's Islam, and you know, we're seeing, as you mentioned, you know, we're seeing now that it really isn't that simple. And even the pathway towards radicalization, as we mentioned, you know, very rarely has to do with actual religious practice and, you know, sophisticated religious understanding. It is, you know, oftentimes religion is a vehicle that is latched onto by some of these individuals, but there's a deeper process that leads towards them committing the violent act. And we saw that also with Faisal Shehzad, and we saw that also with Nabil Hassan Mullick, just to give two examples. And there is a double there's a double standard here in the use of language and labeling, which I think when it's a Muslim, you know, it's even while the investigation is going on, it's jihad and terrorism for sure. When it happens to be someone who isn't Muslim, let's just say a white male, you know, lone wolf, radical, unhinged, let's not unpack the ideology, let's not trace it, you know, let's just, you know, mark them as in the box of lone wolf crazy. And I think that in itself, you know, we could talk about that, is quite problematic.
Well, a term that has come up in the course of the media coverage of this, once it was determined that these two brothers were the ones who had placed the bombs, a term that has come up is self-radicalized. And, you know, that term has started to be used to explain that they did not have any operational or organizational contacts or links to any international terrorist group, but that Tamerlan, the older brother, had on his YouTube page or some social networking page links to videos that were also right. popular favorites of Al-Qaeda terrorists. And so it's sort of a word that has, it's an interesting phrase because it's acknowledging that, as far as we know, he did not have organizational contacts with any international terrorist group, but that, like anyone on the planet with a computer, had access to videos and whatever other materials may be out there. And I don't know, it's sort of an interesting word because once you start, what does it mean, self-radicalized? So does that mean,
Yeah, I think we don't even know what the word, I mean, I don't think we've even come up with a proper definition and understanding of terrorism or terrorist. Let alone, you know, radicalized. And that's what I'm trying to say is, you know, is the terrorism of these brothers very different from the act of terror of Wade Page, you know, the white supremacist who had a history of white supremacism, right? And when last year went into a Sikh temple, I believe in Wisconsin, killed six people. You know, right. What's the difference? You know, why are we so easy and quick to label these brothers terrorists, jihadists? You know, and Wade mm-hmm. Page is still seen as a lone wolf, lone radical. You know, what is the definition of terrorism? What are the categories? Who gets to decide? And I mentioned that in my article because I think mm-hmm. that goes back to what you were just saying is when we look at, you know, I think the reason why people are much more critical now in asking these questions is in light of the tragic numerous shootings that have occurred over the past year. You know, I said Wade Page, for example, you know, Anders Breivik, Jared Loughner, the killer, Lanza, the killer of the school in Newton, and so forth, the Aurora shootings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these were, is terrorism defined as quite literally using violence in a sensationalistic manner and you know, putting people in the groups of terror? Or is the more, you know, traditional understanding of terrorism as the rationalization and use of violence against a civilian population in furtherance of a political or religious ideology? And it goes back to what we've been discussing, that, you know, before motives are ascribed or before anything is really unpacked, once we see that a perpetrator or a suspect is Muslim, we say terrorist or active terrorism. When it happens to be someone else, it's you know, lone wolf. And even like you said, now they're saying self-radicalized. You know, even the definition of radical is something that we haven't really discussed.
Right, because radical can be good.
Political radicals. I mean, spiritual radicals, political radicals, cultural radicals have actually helped make the world. I mean, there. You know, Jesus. I hate using this cliche, but they say Jesus was a radical. Martin Luther King was radical.
It's cliche, right? But right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know,
another context that I was thinking of was Scott Roeder, who is serving a jail sentence for assassinating George Tiller, the doctor who provided abortions in Kansas.
Sure.
And he assassinated him. Roeder assassinated Tiller when Tiller was at church. If that's not an act of terror, you know, to make people feel like, if they work for an abortion clinic or somehow associated or use an abortion clinic, that they should be very afraid. And not only that you should be very afraid in a place where you go for solace and don't expect to be afraid, or guns down, which is at church, or any house of worship. And, you know, Scott Roeder was, you know, has been shown to have been influenced by a very extremist fringe group which believes that Christianity teaches that it's okay to, in fact, right. It's good to shoot an abortion provider or to murder an abortion provider. It's just in furtherance of your point that, you know, in that case, there wasn't a great deal of worry that Christianity was somehow had been broadly radicalized and right. We should be afraid of people like Scott Roeder murdering doctors. But, you know, these brothers were even, you know, he, he was clearly influenced by a very particular religious ideology. I think with the brothers, that they were influenced by a particular religious ideology still has not come together, you know, because his was very much, what he did was very much connected to what he was preaching. You know, he believed that abortion providers should, you know, it's okay to murder an abortion provider. And that's what he went and did. The brothers, not clear still what it was that they were thinking they were accomplishing, and aside from just, you know, kind of a broad-based fear. And I don't know, it just, like you said, the way we talk about these things is not particularly useful, and, you know, just so self-radicalizing is just about as unuseful as saying that Tarmalan had become more devout because he was praying five times a day and criticizing people he didn't think were being, you know, Muslim enough.
And you mentioned, like, I think it's ineffective, and it is very politicized. It's very deliberately politicized. I mean, I remember when we were talking about Anders Breivik, you know, a year and a half ago when it came to the Norway massacre, before any information was ever discovered, if you remember, mainstream newspapers, including the New York Times, you know, kind of inelegantly put in a paragraph about, you know, Islamic terrorism or jihad, even though there was no evidence to even go in that direction. But again, we were so accustomed to that narrative. Okay, what was interesting was, I remember my last blogging appearance, there was a hesitation amongst those who are, if you will, conservative or Republican, to even label Anders Breivik as one of their own tribes, and a huge hesitation to trace his ideology to, like, which is, you know, rooted in, like, right-wing radical, you know, conservatism, if you will, almost, you know, or because the people who he cites are the American Islamophobes in his 1,500-page manifesto.
Right.
He cites Frank Gaffney, he cites Pam Geller. But, you know, I remember in that blogging conversation, you know, the political discourse at that time was, nope, he is a lone wolf and lone radical. And I think the labeling is really key to show how we've kind of even prosecuted the war on terror in the past 12, 13 years. You know, when it comes to the, you know, the white male or the radical right, lone wolf, let's not unpack it, let's not trace the ideological roots. And so much so that, you know, I mentioned in the article, was based off a Wired investigation that Daryl Johnson, who did counterterrorism for the government, has been following the rise of white supremacist groups and you know, radical anti-government groups, and he submitted a study, but that study was actually actively shot down and was sidelined by a conservative congressman and the Department of Homeland Security, right? And speaking about effective policing, let's look at the ineffective policing, where, again, the antagonist, the suspect in this global war on terror, were very comfortable being Muslim, or rather Islam. When we saw, again, like you said, the NYPD widespread surveillance against Muslim communities, that netted nothing, but, you know, it occurred for over a year. And we've seen, you know, nationwide protests against mosques, we've seen mosque crawlers, we've seen community rakers, and, you know, we've seen this huge trust deficit develop between law enforcement and American Muslim communities, especially those who are devout, you know, and we've seen, of course, the exploitation of this, like you mentioned in the beginning, with Peter King, who did these five hearings last year, which, you know, going back to your point of being effective, law enforcement officials and counterterrorism experts said they were actually very ineffective. They accomplished nothing. But mm-hmm. there's a hesitation. So we have no problem doing five hearings focusing on the radicalization of American Muslim communities, whereas, you know, in the present time right now, what we've seen is the highest radical groups, the highest number of radical groups in America belong to three groups: white supremacist groups, radical anti-government groups, and anti-immigrant groups. Yet we see, you know, we don't see this type of language, we don't see this type of labeling, we don't see this type of policing, we don't see this type of white threat surveillance. We don't even want to see, some people don't even want to see an inquiry into this stuff. And I think a lot of that has to do with both the racial component, I think the religious component, because some of these people who do commit these acts happen to be Christian. I'm not religious, but, you know, self-identified as Christian, like Anders Breivik.
Right. But, you know, like in the instance of these brothers, not any kind of Christianity that's recognized or is recognizable to most people.
They're not scholars. Exactly. They're not scholars, and the type of Christianity that they allegedly use to rationalize and validate and legitimize their actions, such as even the abortion bombing that you were talking about, is one that is virtually unrecognizable to the majority of mainstream Christians, both here and abroad.
Mm-hmm. The point being that there's too little understanding of the fact, there's a great deal of understanding of that fact, but there's too little understanding of the fact that to most of the world's Muslims, what the Tarnaev brothers did, if it was indeed in their minds, you know, a defense of Islam, was something that was completely unrecognizable as an expression of Islam.
And I think Chuck Woolery...
Are we going to talk about washed-up game show hosts?
We got to talk about, you know, this is the crazy of the 21st century is that I'm name-dropping Chuck Woolery in a blog in this conversation. but this is the level of sophisticated discourse regarding religion and politics. But, you know, look, Chuck Woolery made mainstream news, for those of you who are watching this who didn't know, by tweeting. Well, he made many, many interesting tweets. But, you know, he says, I'm a self-described conservative, you know, 80s game show host, Love Connection. And, you know, he brought up these memes that we've been talking about. And one of the tweets was, well, all Muslims are not terrorists, but nearly all terrorists are Muslims. You know, dispute that. And, you know, we can dispute that. Like, the facts show that 56% of terror plots in America were actually committed by, you know, exactly these type of radical right-wing groups. I think in the last 12, 15 years, I think there's about 12 to 16% that have been perpetrated by Islamic, quote-unquote, Islamic terrorists. But again, you know, the key, the rise in hate groups. The Southern Poverty Law Center has been following this. You know, we have almost, what, 1,200 hate groups now, Sarah, which is like a record number. There was a record number in 2011, and unfortunately we broke our own record in 2012. And the rise in hate groups are the three groups that I mentioned, you know, white supremacist groups, radical anti-government groups, and anti-immigrant groups. Many of these people, you know, fit a certain profile, quote-unquote profile, of being, you know, the angry, white, conservative males. And many of them, when you ask them about their religion, it's usually Christian. So, first of all, Chuck Woolery was wrong. But it goes to the point where we don't want to have that type of conversation. We're very, you know, comfortable labeling and categorizing and defining terror and terrorism and radicalization when it comes to the brown face, the Muslim face, the devout face, the Islami face. But, you know, if you want to talk about effective policing, if you really want to get to the root of, you know, fighting radicalization, which affects Muslims also, like, you know, for those people who are watching this, I don't think, you know, neither you and I are denying the fact that this reality exists, unfortunately, in some Muslim communities. It exists. And it affects all people, especially Muslims also. I mean, if that, you know, like, look at that Saudi kid, that poor 21-year-old Saudi kid whose crime was to run away from an explosion, right? That's why he was suspect, because he ran away from an explosion. If he was close to the explosion, he would be killed. So, you know, these people, in defending Islam, would kill their own quote-unquote Muslim brothers, right? So the point I'm trying to say is, Muslims, just like Americans, have a vested interest in this, because Muslims also die in acts of terror. But, you know, the net...
And dead in 9/11.
Yeah, even 9/11, yeah, but the net that is cast, the burden of these criminal acts is borne out by, if you will, the majority of Muslims and Muslim Americans who have nothing to do with extremism, right? It's like I always mention, like, the anvil, we're like Daffy Duck, the anvil always drops on our head, whereas when it's like a white radical or white terrorist member, you know, the white majority is like Bugs Bunny. They can just walk around eating a carrot, relax, because they're never asked to, you know, defend, explain, they're never investigated, their whiteness is never interrogated, they're never asked, do you have specialized knowledge as to why one of your fellow white brethren committed this act, even sometimes when they do it in the name of whiteness. So I think, you know, this is where we're at right now, and it really is a hindrance in actually effective policing. If we really sincerely, truly care about our national security, this, you know, these language, these definitions, these narratives really need to be unpacked and rewritten, so we can kind of like chart a more, nuanced history, a nuanced path forward that appreciates the complexity, and also that trickles down, you like how I use that Reagan reference, trickles down to more effective policing. And of course, the last point I'm trying to make is, you know, this stuff is globalized, right? If you're talking about national security, the way we talk about these issues is globalized. Unfortunately, people are paying attention around the world. Whenever I travel around the world, you know, the Muslims abroad know exactly what's happening in America. They follow the rhetoric of Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain. They're like, why is this Godfather pizza guy saying he's going to do loyal votes? Right? Or these anti-Sharia bills, right? They're like, what the hell's happening in America where these anti-Sharia bills are?
Right.
And even then, you know, the West is at war with Islam is unfortunately the number one propaganda tool of our enemies.
Right. Well, speaking of law enforcement, the question that there's a lot of question about, well, you know, if these guys had some connection with, particularly the older brother who traveled back to Russia last year, had some connection with terrorist groups there, the FBI should have found out about it. And unanswered are questions like, how did a guy with a domestic violence conviction, or at least a domestic violence arrest, I guess the charges were dropped eventually, but, you know, a history of domestic violence complaints, at least, and no license to carry a gun, which is required under Massachusetts state law, have weapons. How did they get access to the weapons that they used? You know, so the question is not, how did they figure out how to build a pressure cooker bomb? Because I was at the gym this morning, and I was watching CNN, and they had a story on how easy it is to find out how to build a pressure cooker bomb, and they were basically going through the steps. And I was just like, why are they doing this? But anyway, so, you know, obviously, like, yes, there's crazy information on the internet about how to build a pressure cooker bomb. But really, I mean, since we can't control that, we can't control what's on the internet, we can control, you know, background checks and who can get a gun. And we're not asking those questions. How did these guys
get guns? No, sir, we can't talk about that. We can't talk about gun control. Just, you know, there's been just no proof or evidence or examples of violence that has been caused by our lax gun control. I mean, so that's a completely illegitimate point that you're making. Of course, hopefully you can hear the sarcasm dripping from my voice. No, but you make a really good point about, look, if you want more law enforcement, if you want more surveillance, because look, what we've seen in you know, talk about the exploitation of tragedy for sake of political gain. You know, we've heard people like Peter King say, you know, this is proof that we need more surveillance of Muslim communities. You know, Laura Ingraham says this is proof that we need to end Muslim immigration. You know, or even, you know, other officials saying this is proof that we need to have halt immigration reform. This is proof that we need more national security, and we need to deny people Miranda rights, and we need to hold certain people as enemy combatants, and so forth and so forth. Well, look, the FBI, you know, interviewed the dude and released him. Okay, what more do you want? At the same time, if you remember what we call the Nigerian underwear bomber who failed in his quest to blow up the airplane when he landed in Detroit, his father actually tipped off law enforcement that my son is radicalized, and that the gentleman's name should have been on the no-fly list, and yet he was still able to board a plane. and, you know, and land in America. And I think so. That's what we're seeing is, you know, we've had enough policing. We just need intelligent, effective policing, right? And what we've seen that again is what you've accomplished is instead is unfortunately you kind of traded rights for the illusory feeling of safety. And usually the rights that are compromised around these moments are the rights of our of the minorities, of the marginalized of our communities. So it's kind of like, okay, we'll trample on the civil liberties and rights of those who are deemed Muslimy because it will make me feel, quote unquote, more safe, even though by doing so, I'm voluntarily giving up more and more of my freedoms and liberties, and I'm not actually making the country safer. And I think this is why we need to really bring this up, because there are people who will try to score political points on this and try to justify their 5 congressional hearings, and yet, as we've seen, it actually does not lead to a more safe, secure nation, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, even that it became a discussion point that the younger brother, who is an American citizen, could be tried as an enemy combatant, which, you know, was pretty quickly shot down. But the idea that it was even contemplated was, I mean, you don't think that the American criminal justice system is good enough to convict a guy who's on videotape placing a bomb in public?
Well, I mean, it seems kind of
preposterous.
Yeah, I mean, it also shows that, unfortunately, our elected officials don't even know our own laws and how and who
right.
may be, you know...
Because obviously it would have been illegal to do that. But, you know, it also indicates some sort of, like I said, lack of confidence in the normal criminal justice system,
right.
which is designed to handle a case like that. And so, but they did, you know, on the good news front, I guess, they did Mirandize him. So I think that they did question him a little bit before they gave him his Miranda warning. But at least... I think that was something that civil liberties people were concerned about, that he wasn't going to be Mirandized at all.
I think what it goes back to is like this exotification of certain types of criminal behavior, and I think certain types of criminals. You know, it goes, and we kind of keep coming back to this point. You know, it seems that, you know, when a criminal misdeed is done by certain type of people for certain motivations, you know, we need to completely abandon the traditional forms of law enforcement and prosecution and security because we're dealing with, you know, a special kind of evil, right? And it goes back to this type of language that we've used, you know, this special type of enemy, a special type of evil, a person who, you know, is in conflict with Western culture and Western ideas, a person who hates freedom, you know, these devout fundamentalists, they don't understand and appreciate or comprehend these bedrocks of our Western culture, right? And as such, you know, we need to use a specific type of advanced, enhanced language and interrogation and torture and surveillance and law enforcement to take the fight to these enemies. Otherwise, you know, freedom will fail. And I think that's kind of been the narrative that's unfortunately popularized by certain political and cultural entities of the past 13, 14 years. And I think it's exactly what goes back to what we're talking about, is that, you know, when it's a Muslim or when it's a Muslim face, it's much more easy to demonize them as this, you know, this new architect of terror, this very unique brand of evil that, you know, but as we've seen with counterterrorism experts, when they've actually analyzed the profiles of radicals in general, you know, that they're really not that unique, if you will. Right, the process towards radicalization for most of these individuals, regardless of even, you know, whether it's political rationalizations or religious rationalization or ethnic rationalizations, is, you know, you're essentially seeing a very diverse profile, but you're seeing that, like, similar pathways and process towards radicalization, right? And I think we're kind of dealing with that. You know, when it's a Muslim, it's terrorism, you know, enemy combatant, you know, war on terror, you know, West versus Islam. However, when it's someone else, you know, unhinged gunman. Lone radical. And of course, it plays out in the national conversation, it plays out in prosecution, it plays out in law enforcement. And, you know, it's something that you and I have kind of gone back and forth on this past 50 minutes. We kind of just see this keep playing out. This narrative just keeps being played out this way. It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks a lot for doing this. It was a good discussion.
Yeah, thanks for so much for asking me. Hopefully next time we can talk about, you know, something more heartwarming and uplifting. Or we can talk about...
Okay, maybe we can talk about more interesting washed-up game show hosts or something.
Yeah, that would be an amazing blog of his.
Okay, thanks. So we're back to do a short addendum to the program that we recorded earlier today. A couple of hours after we finished recording, the AP broke a pretty big story about an individual who was thought to have a great deal of influence over Tamerlan Tsarnaev, an individual who's identified in the piece only as Misha, an Armenian recent convert to Islam, otherwise not a lot of information about him. But I think that the piece points to something that we were talking about earlier, which is that the term you used was religious novice. And the piece talks about different things that Misha allegedly taught Tamerlan about Islam, and that apparently Tamerlan bought her, you know, hook, line, and sinker, perhaps. And the piece also discusses that his family seemed a little disturbed by the influence that this Misha character had over him.
Yeah, it seems like, like we said, the main question is where in the world is Misha? And then who is Misha? But, you know, what's interesting is, like you mentioned, there's two things. Number one, it does confirm all the counterterrorism and counter-extremism reports that we've seen in the past, you know, 12 years, that suggest that these people who do become a terrorist or radicalized, however you want to define it, are religious novices. They don't have a sophisticated understanding of religion, and most of them aren't actually even that practicing, mm-hmm. number one. Number two, I think what's fascinating that what we were talking about is that even his family, you know, Tamerlan's family, his father in particular, had a diversity of interpretations of Islam and what they thought Islam meant. Mm-hmm. And as we saw in that AP mm-hmm. story, the father seemed to be quite displeased with this gentleman's influence and some of the, you know, some of the theories or the interpretation that this gentleman was espousing to allegedly influence Tamerlan, especially when it came to this whole concept of, I think, was it dropping out of music school or music class? You know, the father was asking, yeah, the right. father asked his elder brother, you know, eldest son, Tamerlan, you know, what about the music class? And then he says, no, I don't do that anymore. That's, you know, against Islam. So mm-hmm. I think it does show you that, you know, quote unquote, what is Islam? It depends on the, you know, interpretation and practice of its 1.5 billion adherents. And these individuals like Tamerlan, who go through what seems like is a radicalization process, aren't really that religious, number one, are religious novices, number two. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, their actions, their conduct, and even, you know, many of their understandings of Islam lie outside of what most religiously adherent or pious, or like we mentioned before, devout Muslims would consider it as being mm-hmm. traditional. I think that's interesting to unpack.
Well, you know, in the piece talks about how his mother apparently seemed to buy some of this stuff that or at least not question the fact that Tamerlan was learning something or picking up something from this Misha character. But the father seemed disturbed by it. The father seemed to indicate, or was it the father or the uncle, that this was not the sort of Islam that they grew up with or that he was raised in.
Yeah, essentially, because even I think we have so many different characters now. It seems like, you know, we do need a reality TV show. A surreal reality TV show, but like, you know, Uncle Ruslan, who did the press conference, and even the father, you know, they identify as Muslim, they identify as Sunni Muslim, they were raised with a Sunni Muslim background, and for all intents and purposes, mm-hmm. they seem to be practicing. And it just goes to show you that, you know, even they don't really, it seems from what they're saying, they're shocked by the turn of events that have turned these two young, otherwise quote-unquote normal men to allegedly commit these acts. And both have renounced mm-hmm. it, both as, you know, as family members, they've renounced it, on an emotional level, they've renounced it, on an ideological level, they've renounced it, and they've also renounced it as Muslims, as being, you know, outside the folds of Islam. And I think that's really interesting, but what I also want to, you know, I've learned from this mistake also that, unfortunately, I made, and so many other people did, is we don't know who Misha is, we haven't heard Misha's side of the mm-hmm. story. You know, it could very well be that mm-hmm. Misha is like this conservative uncle from the community, who was like, okay, here's this young kid who's taken an interest in Islam. I love Islam. Let me, you know, proselytize to him and take him under my wing. Now, was mm-hmm. that a quote-unquote radical mm-hmm. wing? Was that just a conservative wing? Was it, you know, we don't know. And I'm really going to be hesitant to kind of haze or condemn this mythical Misha with no last name.
Right. Well, we don't know what he actually said to Tsarnaev, and we don't know how Tsarnaev processed it, right? So he could have taken little bits of information from Misha and maybe from some other people and maybe from something he read on the internet and like mixed it all together in some, you know, crackpot theory that he had reading InfoWars, because that's what the article also says, that he was a reader and follower of that. So, you know, I think the Misha thing is, number one, it's a rebuttal of sorts to people who would say that Islam is an inherently violent religion and that it's Islam that causes someone to commit a terrible act like this. You know, the fact that there was pushback in the family from, if it was Misha disseminating these ideas, let's assume for the moment that it was, you know, that sort of dispels that myth. And the other thing is that you know, Misha, we don't know how this all, like I said, all got mixed in with what Tsarnaev was thinking. And I just think that, you know, sometimes things are not so easily explained by, he was hanging out with Misha and Misha told him this crazy stuff and therefore it's radical Islam that was influencing him. I think that there was a lot of stuff going into this mix, including conspiracy theories, which are obviously not exclusive to Islam. I think that there might be an overfocus on Misha. You know, as a result of this, because I think people are looking for where did he learn this version of Islam? He learned it from Misha. It's like, okay, well, you know, we don't know that yet.
You touched upon that. It's like this strong, intense desire and obsession for us to hang our hat on one villain. One villain, you know, is it InfoWars? Is it the mom? Is it Misha? Is it radical Islam? Is it the internet? Like, we have to blame mm-hmm. one culprit. We need a simplistic and scapegoat for this.
Yeah.
And as we've discussed for the past, you know, hour, that scapegoat is Islam, and then Islam would then be personified by Misha. But as we've seen in the process of radicalization of so many people, like Tamerlan and others who radicalize not due to religion, but say due to you know, politics or you know, other religious groups or separatist movements and so forth. You know, the it takes a process towards radicalization. It usually just doesn't happen overnight. And it seems from what we know so far, piecing together the evidence, that seems to be a complex journey was undertaken by Tamerlan. It just didn't happen overnight. And it seems like, and I agree with you, it seems like a mishmash of, you know, okay, maybe it was his visit abroad, maybe he was unemployed, you know, he had to give up his boxing career, he felt increasingly alienated, he got into contact with maybe this Misha guy who put stuff in his head. We don't know. But again, I think, you know, it's very easy, reductive, simplistic, and I think irresponsible to blame, quote-unquote, Islam. Because as we've seen, you know, Islam doesn't speak, Muslims do. And as we've seen from just this case in point example, Muslims seem to be, you know, speak very diversely and differently, and have a diversity of interpretations of how they practice and live out the religion. And, you know, the father and the uncle in particular seem to be examples of what we've seen repeatedly in America and abroad, that those who identify with religion and religiously practicing seem to be much more deterred from behaving like, you know, extremists, really.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks for talking about Misha.
Thanks so much. Take care. All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care.